You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Blake Smith from Monster Talk.
Why are you calling at this time?
Well, you told me you'd help me inject some science content into my episode about kaiju, and I wanted to ask for your thoughts about some claims that many people have been making, that in 1954, the city of Tokyo was attacked by a giant radioactive mutated dinosaur.
No, nobody's claiming that. That's just a film.
Okay. Well, what about the claims that 1955, that same monster returned to attack Japan yet again?
Also, just a film.
Well, can you address the many sightings of a giant moth that engaged in battle with this same giant radioactive dinosaur beast in 1964?
Again, that is just... It's a film, Blake.
Okay. Well, what about the alleged incident that took place in 1962 when this mysterious reptile was forced into combat with what many claimed was a giant ape?
Yeah, that was based on an actual incident, a thing that actually happened in 1951.
Really?
No, not really. That was also just a film.
Look, I called you for some science, and I have to say this is not very helpful.
You said you were going to ask something sensible, about Bigfoot or something.
Okay. Here's one that sounds very scientific. How about the alleged case of a giant three-headed monster that...
Oh, I don't think you're getting it. Just a film!
Dang it! Now who am I going to get to help me talk about Godzilla and giant monsters for the show?
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. As you may have guessed based on the intro, this is a special episode about Godzilla and other giant monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Karen Stolzner, we examine the legends and facts behind legendary monsters. But sometimes, we like to take a look at purely fictional creatures, and that's what we're doing today. A special thanks to Darren Naish of the Tetrapod Zoology blog and the Tet Zoo Podcasts. Darren wrote a wonderful piece on the biology of Godzilla back in 2010, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Because of the length of this episode, I'm going to keep the intro short, but this is a topic I really love and I hope you enjoy listening to it. I want to give a quick reminder that we're a podcast created by science advocates and skeptics, but we love monsters. And we always like to remind people that anybody can have a weird experience, even hardcore skeptics. To really illustrate this point, my co-host Karen has put together an anthology of real-life stories of odd occurrences by some of the most prominent skeptics out there. I really encourage you to go to Amazon and check it out. A link to her book, Would You Believe It? Mysterious Tales from People You Would Least Expect, is available in paperback and e-reader now. One note, As sometimes happens, we had some issues with the audio, and I had to recover from a backup copy, and the interview was spread across two recording sessions, which ended up with wildly varying audio quality in the two segments. I've done my best to minimize that, but apologize to any audiophiles out there.
Monster Talk.
Today, we're talking to Michael Keller and Ed Gottschalksi.
Michael is the co-editor of Monster Attack Team magazine, along with the founder, Edward Holland, and the upcoming co-host of an Area 42 podcast, and we'll put links to that in the show notes, monsterattackteam.com, and then the Area 42 podcast, I assume, will be available in whatever podcast aggregator you use. But again, when that goes live, we'll get the show notes updated to have the active link for that. And Ed is the publisher of Japanese Giants magazine. He's the author of the Illustrated Encyclopedia of Godzilla. He's a producer and writer of the documentary Bringing Godzilla Down to Size. He has provided DVD commentary for Toho Films along with Steve Reifel. And is the co-author, again with Steve Reifel, of Ashiro Honda, A Life from Godzilla to Kurosawa, which is due to be published in October 2017. Thank you for joining us on Monster Talk, guys.
Pleased to be here.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a big topic, obviously, and it's one that I've been wanting to talk about for a while. You know, a lot of time on Monster Talk, we deal with cryptids, but we do like to talk about folklore and pop culture monsters as well. And I think it's hard to overstate the impact of giant monsters on pop culture. They're everywhere. They're in advertising. They're in stories. They're in movies. They're in poetry.
And they've always been around, too. Going all the way back to mythology, you know.
That's a very good point. Yes, excellent. Yeah. So I kind of want to focus on the impact of Japanese cinema, but it's really a global phenomenon, as you say, and it's
started come up with the Japanese, didn't it?
Well, it depends on how you classify it, I guess. I kind of think of King Kong as the first giant monster movie, although I think The Lost World actually predates that.
Well, King Kong, I think, was the first giant monster movie where the monster was unique. Lost World was just dinosaurs.
Good point.
Yeah, the plot of The Lost World was almost exactly the same as King Kong, except instead of having a giant ape, you had an apatosaurus that filled that role. And it didn't get hooked up with any blonde chicks.
I guess the first question is, what is a kaiju, or what are kaiju?
If I'm not mistaken, I think the literal translation of the Japanese word kaiju is strange creature. And I think colloquially it means monster. And if you add a dai to that, dai kaiju, that means giant monster. I'll welcome Ed's input on that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's any number of ways that you can translate that particular word, but you know, as Mike has pointed out, the popular translation is literally weird creature. But you know, in the case of monster movies in Japan, you know, kaiju has been the word that has been attached to this particular genre.
There's also another word that has not been made as popular over here, but is used in Japan, called kaijin. That's J-I-N as opposed to J-U. Mm-hmm. And that's used for monsters that are of the same size as human beings. In the television shows such as Kamen Rider and other superhero shows, they use the word kaijin. But we don't really use that over here yet.
From a historical perspective, I guess when you think about... I assume Godzilla was the first of these, but I might be wrong on that. So if Godzilla was the first of the giant Japanese monsters, were they calling them kaiju back then?
That word was used from the beginning. Supposedly, there were two movies about King Kong that came out in 1933 or thereabouts in Japan that are now completely lost forever, that nobody has any hope of ever seeing again. I have seen supposed synopses of those that have come to light recently, where it turns out that there may not have been monsters in them at all, just some guy in a monkey suit playing King Kong. But that's the extent of what I know about it.
Yeah, I've only seen a picture of from one, and you know, no footages ever surface on these that I'm aware of.
Maybe it will, though. That's one of that's like the Thomas Edison version of Frankenstein. It's one of those famous lost cinema, and I think a little bit of that footage is still around, but
the whole movie has been found. It's on YouTube. You can see it.
Neat. So yeah. I knew they had recovered some of it. I didn't know how far that had gone. And then what's the other one? It was the Lon Chaney one. Was it like London After Midnight?
London, I think? After Midnight, yeah. No, yeah. But yeah, that's completely lost.
And then they did a Turner Classic Movies did a presentation where they basically put it together with a series of production stills and made sort of a, here's what it would have looked like, which right. was pretty interesting. Why Godzilla, I guess, is what I'm curious about. I mean, where does this come from, and how did it impact Japanese culture? I mean, I know how it impacted American culture, but maybe just talk about the story of Godzilla, how it came to be, and the American distribution and why there's a difference in the versions.
Well, as far as the first film, the popular story that has been put forth by the producer, Tomoyuki Tanaka, is that he came up with it while he was on a plane coming back from Indonesia, where one of his major co-productions with the Indonesian government had fallen through, and he was suddenly without, you know, a big blockbuster that he was looking to produce for that, you know, for that time period of 1953. And he's flying out over the, you know, over the ocean back to Japan, and he looks down at the ocean and he comes up with the idea of, you know, well, what if some kind of giant creature from under the ocean were to appear? And, you know, this is kind of like his popular myth that he created. But basically, you know, at that time, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms had just come out in America and was a huge success. So, you know, being one of the top producers at Toho in Japan at that time, I mean, he's very well aware of the box office trends, what's going on in the world of cinema. And so I think he took a look at that and said, well, why don't we do the same thing? And at the same time, I believe King Kong had just been reissued in Japan around that time and had done very well. So it seemed like the time was good. Timing was good for a giant monster film.
If I'm not mistaken, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was made because King Kong had just come on television in the U.S. in 1952 for the first time, and that ended up being a big hit. Do you have any remembrances of that, Ed?
No. I mean, I hadn't heard that story before, but I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if
that was. That was correct me if I'm wrong. That's the version. That's the Harryhausen film that was based on the Lighthouse short story by Bradbury. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, I know that those two had been huge fans of King Kong. In fact, Harryhausen had done work with was it Willis O'Brien to learn right. how to do some of the stop motion stuff. So. I know those guys love dinosaurs and love giant monsters. I'm sure they were thrilled at the opportunity to produce one on screen. But that was still a story about an ancient creature that was just still alive somehow, right? I mean, there's no atomic factor there, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yes, absolutely. There was an atomic factor.
Oh, there was, okay. Was it atomic bombs at the beginning that woke it up?
Yes. And if we're talking about The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms?
Yes, yeah, because I was trying to figure out with Godzilla what the tie-in was. I mean, obviously, thematically, there's the big...
As a matter of fact, I've heard, and, well, directly from the man himself, Harryhausen was very resentful of Godzilla because he thought it was a one-up attempt on The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, so he didn't care for Godzilla at all.
Well, I don't know that Harryhausen resented the fact that they made something in a similar vein to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I think what he really resented was the technique that they used to create the monster. He just felt that Man in the Suit was a cheap and not very effective way to create special effects.
I had heard him say that himself, actually.
Yeah, okay, well, anyway, that's... That's not the story that I always read about. But in any case, you know, the origin of Godzilla still, you know, goes back more to current events at the time. And right around the time that they were looking to produce the film, we had the Lucky Dragon number 5 incident, where a Japanese fishing boat wandered into one of the atomic bomb test zones accidentally, and the crew got exposed to radiation and they came back and were very sick, and it caused a huge uproar in Japan at that time, that Japanese citizens again were subject to the effects of radiation from the atomic bomb. And it was that, you know, that kind of hook that also Tanaka seized on, that there was, you know, some atopical event that they could use to tie into this monster film and, you know, give it some political relevance at the time. So they, you know, they put together a crew. Eiji Tsuburaya was a very famous special effects guy in Japan, and he'd been wanting for many, many, many years to do some kind of a monster film because he was such a great admirer of King Kong. And this gave him his opportunity. And they, so Tsuburaya was assigned to the project, and they picked a director who was available, named Ishiro Honda, who had worked with Tsuburaya the year before on Eagle of the Pacific, a big special effects extravaganza. So, you know, given the fact that those two had worked together successfully, Honda seemed like the ideal candidate. Although, from what I understand, he was not the first choice for directing Godzilla. They had picked instead one of his friends and colleagues, Senkichi Taniguchi, to do that. But he didn't want to go anywhere near something like a giant monster film because, like a lot of people, you know, they feel like if you work on that kind of a project, you're going to get pigeonholed into that kind of thing. And, you know, professionally, that's not the direction a lot of people wanted to go. But Honda thought that this was a really great opportunity to make a statement about nuclear energy and the atomic bomb. And so he very eagerly signed on to the project.
What about the American takes on kaiju? What can you tell us about films like Cloverfield and Colossal and Pacific Rim?
A lot of them do freely reference the Japanese films as influences, especially in Pacific Rim, where they go out of their way to use the word kaiju. So that, you know, it's very in your face in that case.
Yes, with giant robots too. So
yeah.
I don't know enough about Japanese culture. Is there a special name for giant robot movies as opposed to giant monster movies?
No. Okay. but two other words, well, at least one other word that might be important would be tokusatsu, which is the Japanese word for live-action special effects films. And that would not just cover the kaiju ega or monster movies, but also space operas and anything, any type of Japanese sci-fi, and movies with giant robots would be considered tokusatsu ega, and television shows would be called terabi tokusatsu.
Okay, and so you said that there were some American films that had that similar theme of radiation-created creatures. What are some of those ones?
Them, about the giant ants from radiation. I think the Deadly Mantis was caused by radioactivity or was awoken. We've already mentioned The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And there was a British film called The Giant Behemoth, which was radioactive.
Okay, and were they influenced by any events that took place in the States or just the Japanese-style films?
I think it was just the Cold War and the duck and cover culture that was going on at the time.
Yeah, in the 50s, they were still doing atomic bomb testing in the desert in the Southwest, and that's pretty much directly referenced in, especially in Them, that that's really the reason why these mutated ants were created.
Right.
But you know, just the fact that, you know, the atomic age was just something that was really in the news, and there was testing, and the Cold War was going on where people were feeling the nuclear threat.
Mm-hmm.
That became a very easy hook for science fiction filmmakers to grab onto, and
sure.
Radiation was kind of like the magic ingredient to explain away a lot of the giant monsters in science fiction films of that era.
Sure,
I think that had something to do with finding vegetation that was extremely large that happened after some of these atomic tests, and I believe that's where that idea came from.
Yeah, I've been actually trying to track that down with a little bit more precision, and I unfortunately haven't found a case zero, if you will, but I'd like to. But But I think you can draw a really nice story of where you've got the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms with a nuclear bomb, and then Godzilla. And then in the same year, you get them, which is absolutely radiation-based giantism. And yes. And once that's become established as a successful trope, movies after that don't really have to explain it. They just say, oh, radiation. And you know, everybody's, oh, of course, radiation, right?
They paved the way.
Yeah. Another one would be The Amazing Colossal Man and its sequel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, War of the Colossal Beast.
My son is a huge giant monster fan, and we've got a pretty extensive collection of these films, including some pretty obscure ones.
Good for you, yeah. Get them started right.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you got to be a good parent, right? It's like, I don't know that they're going to like monsters when they grow up, but they're sure going to be educated about them. So,
well, we do. Yeah.
The one of the things that I find really interesting, though, is we had the good opportunity to go see the original. I'm going to call it Gojira.
That's one of my pet peeves right there.
Explain.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said before when I mentioned that was one of my pet peeves, what I was referring to was the pronunciation of Godzilla's Japanese name. Because everybody always says Gojira, but that's not correct. It's Gojira with the accent on the go rather than the Jira. The word Gojira was made from the Japanese words Gorira, gorilla, and Kujira, which is whale. So Godzilla, Gojira is literally a gorilla whale.
The original Japanese version, not the American release, was quite different. The American release, and I'm sure you guys can talk about this more accurately, but the American release was heavily edited and inserted Raymond Burr, who was never involved with principal filming in any way.
Right.
His character, Steve Martin, was just not a part of the original story. And the American version, if you ever get a chance to compare it to the actual Japanese version, is a watered down mess. It's just ridiculous. And the original, I'll let you guys talk about your thoughts on it, but I found it to be an incredibly serious film, and not at all the sort of silly, guy in a giant, monster costume that it sort of Godzilla became recognized as later. It's just a very dark, serious film. It would have been an awesome anime, honestly. But for what it is, I thought it was very successful.
Well, everybody who has seen it thinks that, except for Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert aside, I think still, the American version gets a lot of grief and a lot of hate. But honestly speaking, I think, under the circumstances, if the American version hadn't been made the way it was, that film probably would have never been released over here, and this phenomenon may not have taken place.
At that period in time,
exploitation films were all the rage, and this was just one new commodity that the producers in Hollywood could tap and say, okay, well, we have a ready-made film here, but gee, that has nothing to do with America. There's nothing that people can really relate to, and there's no stars. There's nothing. But if we add a little footage of our own and put it out there, we'll go see it because it's monsters were selling at that time, but they needed a way to sell it in the States, so they made a version that could sell here. And that's what really opened the door, not only for giant monster films from Japan, but basically it introduced Japanese cinema to the Western world. I mean, you can talk all you want about art house projects like Rashomon and that were getting seen in the West, but that was just a pimple on the face of the box office. Nobody, there was no box office being generated by those kind of films. It was Honda's films that really made money for the Western world and introduced the world to Japanese cinema. So, I believe that, it was the right decision and it was the right way to go. I don't believe that it's so terribly watered down that it's a bad film in the way it was made. And in fact, I think in some ways it's very ingenious the way they put Burr into it, because it took me many years before I really recognized what they had done with it and how they had masked the fact that he was not part of the original production. You know, right now it's easy for us to see that because we have the convenience of video where you can go back and watch the same film 100 times at your convenience. But you know, way back in the 50s, the 60s, and 70s, there was nothing like that. I mean, if you're lucky, you saw it on TV once every, you know, couple years, and people weren't able to sit there and overanalyze films like you can today. And for the time, this was, I believe, the right decision for them to make, and it was quite effective in getting these films out to the public and opening the door for all these other films to come to America.
Talk to us a little bit about the various film periods that are surrounding Godzilla and his kin, like a millennium and Showa.
Showa period is usually the period of Japanese film that's supposed to coincide with, I believe, the life of Emperor Hirohito. Is that correct, Ed?
Yes.
Yes, and that officially ended, what year did he die?
I think it was 88 or 89. I think it must have been 89.
Right, but when we get into the into Toho and into Kaiju Ega and Terabi Tokusatsu films, when we break them up into these different series, the Showa, the Heisei, and the Millennium, they don't really coincide exactly to what those specifically are. I mean, for instance, the Showa period for Godzilla films is considered to end in 1975 with Terror of Mechagodzilla. And the next film would be Godzilla 1984, which over here was Godzilla 1985, and that's considered the start of the Heisei series. But that literally was a Showa film too, because Hirohito was still alive.
Well, and, as far as I know, what I've seen in Japan, I don't see anybody considering the 84 film as being a Heisei film. It's story-wise, it's part of it, you could consider it as part of that series, but it, I mean, even if you look at books that come out that call themselves Heisei period, you know, 84 is not included in that.
Yeah, well, fandom so they, over here, they, though, they, yeah,
they do pretty strictly stick to the emperor's, you know, naming convention, you know, the Heisei emperor being Hirohito.
Right. And so literally, we're still in the Heisei period, although, again, for fandom over here, the Heisei period was considered to end with Godzilla versus Destoria in or Destroyer, or however you're going to pronounce it, in 1995. And I think after that, we had a lamentable American version in 1998. Yeah. Then Toho started back up in 1999 with Godzilla 2000, and those series of films through Godzilla Final Wars in 2004 are considered the Millennium series, although, as Ed's pointed out, technically they're still part of Heisei.
Yeah.
And I remains yet to be seen if we're going to assign a new moniker to the films that are coming out in the wake of Shin Godzilla.
Well, you know, this is what you want to talk about, pet peeve. For me, one of the pet peeves is, you know, why do people, and especially in this country, I think it's ridiculous that they, you know, refer to these films as Showa and Heisei, because those terms have absolutely no meaning to people here. You know, to me, it's easy enough to say original series, the 90s series, and the, you know, 2000s or the millennium series. To me, it makes much more sense. It's just like using, you know, other you know, borrowed words from Japanese to describe what there is a perfectly valid translation for in English. I think it's probably just like, you know, a fandom thing that people like to do that. Like it's a way to, you know, somehow own this in a different way than, you know, or distinguish it from other kinds of genres, but. I don't know. To me, it just never made it, you know, a whole lot of sense why people would do that, other than they're, you know, maybe trying to, you know, sound more Japanese or something. But,
well,
you know, but like, okay, like so, kaiju is, you know, kaiju means monster. So I really never quite got the idea of why do we have to refer to monsters as kaiju, because they're monsters. There's a perfectly valid translation for it. When you have words that there is no translation for, yeah, sure, I can easily see using a Japanese term for that. But in a case like, especially like something like monsters, I always thought, why would people even use that?
Monsters. Well, so it's funny that you bring that up. This is not one of our prepared questions, but there is the whole thing about within fandom, you end up with something kind of like the word they use, the shibboleth, right? You get these words that are kind of in-group, out-group code words, right? So when you know the words, it's a way to tell other people that you have a mastery of this subculture, right? Or at least that's my thought. But
I would agree with you with that.
Yeah. So
that's what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people in fandom get really, really involved in all the nuances and minutiae, both of the stuff that happens inside these fantasy and fictional products, properties, and outside culturally, with like the stories about the actors and the directors and the trivia. And I, as a fan myself, I don't know why I get so excited about that information, but I love knowing more about it, and I hope our listeners are enjoying this.
I especially like the idea that people want to be interested in the information, because all too often I think in fandom especially, people are far more interested in toys and merchandise than they are about the actual films themselves. I mean, that's... Unfortunately, that's why I have suspended publication of my magazine, because I make this magazine and I research all the materials and stuff to try and put together an interesting set of articles. But people aren't that interested in buying magazines, because they have to read and learn. And it seems like, a piece of a hunk of vinyl that's shaped vaguely in the shape of a monster is 100 times more interesting to people. So that kind of is a little bit depressing. So it's nice to hear that there are people who are interested in learning about the films. But, to go back to the terminology, I guess the thing that takes me back from that too is, it's almost like a way to, as you say, maybe it's like your badge of honor for being a fan or something. But at the same time, I also always feel that people who aren't that familiar with this but are interested in the subject, it's a kind of way to exclude people from really sharing in the fandom. When we have put together our DVD commentaries, and especially in writing the Honda book, we go out of our way to not use those kind of terms, because not everybody who's going to be listening to our commentaries or reading the book are familiar with that. And we're hoping that they will become familiar and become fans. But if you start out talking kaiju and eiga and terms like, and tokusatsu films like that, or terms like that, you wind up confusing and basically excluding people who aren't intimately familiar with it. In an effort to try and get everybody interested in this subject, Steve and I have gone out of our way to kind of avoid using those kind of terms. And
then you probably get people who complain, thinking that you should be using them.
Oh yeah. to which I always answer just what I told you, is that I don't feel it's not something I think that we should be looking at as an exclusive club. It's something that I like to welcome everybody in. A lot of the things that we do in terms of our research is to point out to people that these are not, according to popular myth, cheap, cheesy, lousy films that they didn't care about, that they just made on the fly just to make a quick buck. No, they're films that people pour their hearts and souls into making, and there's a lot of stories behind these people, and that's what we really want to bring out to the general public, to give them an appreciation for the craftsmanship and the work and the dedication of all these people who put these films together. Doing this, the Honda biography is a perfect example of that. I mean, Honda you talk to general film critics who are always very dismissive of science fiction, and you know, you'll bring up Godzilla or any of these Japanese science fiction films, and they're always very dismissive. Oh, that guy was a hack. He's nobody. They're just, you know, churning out product. They don't really care. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth.
As you'll find out when you read Ed's biography on Honda. In fact, it's in the title of the book. It goes, it's From Godzilla to Kurosawa. I might go as far to say that Honda's best friend in the world was Akira Kurosawa. Would you say that, Ed?
Yeah, that would be an accurate statement. Those two, they were like oil and water. They're opposites, but they became best friends. And, you know, the most famous and revered filmmaker in Japanese cinema history is Kurosawa. But Kurosawa, you know, he always deferred to Honda, and he trusted his judgment implicitly, and felt he was every bit as talented a filmmaker as he was. Just they worked on different projects, and they had different styles of working. Once Honda had retired and Kurosawa was struggling getting some film projects off the ground, they kind of renewed their friendship that they had struck up when they were both, you know, apprentice filmmakers back at, you know, when Toho was first starting. And they just said, you know, let's get together and let's go back to the old days and just make movies the old way. And that was what they did. And they didn't really even see that there was much of a dividing line between their duties. You know, Honda was a very modest guy, so of course he always deferred to Kurosawa and let him, you know, be the lead man. But behind the scenes, he was every bit as influential on these films as Kurosawa was.
Now, I'm trying to imagine Godzilla versus Toshiro Mifune. So could he withstand the samurai attack? I don't know.
Well, one of the actors who was inside the Godzilla costume, Kenpachiro Satsuma, Toshiro Mifune is his favorite actor. And I don't really have anything else to add to that.
But there's so many monsters now that are in the Godzillaverse. Now, is there some, I say Godzillaverse all the time, but is there some Japanese name for that sort of collection of those creatures, Anguirus, Rodan, Mothra, Ghidra, that sort of thing?
I just call it the Rogues Gallery. I don't have
Rogues Gallery. Yeah, so I was curious, is there, could you talk a little bit about how all these auxiliary monsters went from being their own little feature film characters to becoming part of this bigger shared universe? Because, I mean, this kind of, in a way, predates the sort of Marvel shared continuity. I don't know of any other property where they've done so much crossover.
Well, they kind of did in the old Universal monster films, Frankenstein, Wolfman, and Dracula. Throughout the 1940s, those characters would end up in films together. And of course, that had been done in literature before, too. Like everything that Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote, that all existed in the same universe, and he wrote a lot of stuff. But how they all ended up in the same universe together, I don't know if there's a particular story about that. I just think that they made some of these movies separately, and then they decided to make movies where these two of these creatures would appear in the same film together, and it worked. The movies made money, so they kept doing it. Yeah,
I don't think it was really by design. It was, you know, you started out in the 50s, and they had all these separate films that they were making. There was never any idea of any particular continuity. You had Godzilla, Rodan, Mothra, you know, various films like that were made, and then at a certain point, as the box office started getting decreasing a little bit and television started eroding the market for films, they're still looking to make more films. I mean, they could have continued trying one-off properties, but, you know, as King Kong versus Godzilla showed them, bringing back an old character in the case of Godzilla, you know, Godzilla hadn't appeared for, 7 years since the previous film, when they brought Godzilla back for King Kong versus Godzilla, that made money. So, you know, being smart producers, they see what makes money, and they decided to continue down the same path. And that meant, you know, making more versus movies, and one of the best or easiest ways for them to do that was to rely on established characters, which they already had out there, and, you know, on occasion adding new ones in. So things like King Ghidorah appeared and were added. But basically it's, you know, I think it was just a matter of judging the market of what was selling at that time and going forward with that.
So can you talk to us a little bit about some of the common kaiju misconceptions and the falsehoods that are around?
Well, one that I already mentioned was the pronunciation of a Gojira. But there's one that was around for a very long time, that there were two endings to King Kong versus Godzilla, which was never true. There's only one ending to that film.
Wonder how that got started then.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
If you want nightmares, you are in the right place.
I couldn't sleep last night after listening.
This podcast is genuinely scary.
That's what people are saying about Frightful. And if you'd like a few nightmares of your own, then how about you step this way? Hi, I'm Peter Laws, and I'm an author, journalist, and the host of Frightful, the podcast that is giving folks the serious creeps. From spine-tingling tales of the paranormal and shocking true crime to disturbing cults, possessions, and the forgotten horrors of history, Frightful is the podcast that pulls you into the darkness with immersive music, sound effects, and storytelling that is designed with one thing in mind: to get under your skin. With new episodes every other Sunday, you'll have plenty to keep that heart rate high. The good news is it's available free wherever you get your podcasts. The bad news is that after listening to this show, you might just have to spend a few more cents on electricity. After all, you're going to be sleeping with the lights on. So search Frightful in your podcast apps, and I will see you there in the dark.
Well, supposedly it was made popular in Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, but I don't think Forrest J. Ackerman made it up. I got, because I met him once and I asked him about it. I got the impression that he still thought it was true. So I think that he misheard something, or somebody else told him, and I don't know who that would be. Maybe somebody at Universal. Something that's interesting about that, though, is that there are some movies that actually do have two endings, including Japanese monster movies. One of them is Frankenstein Conquers the World. But both of those endings are on the DVD, but I only think one of them ever actually was shown theatrically.
Yes, that's correct.
Which ending was shown theatrically?
It's the one that has the giant Frankenstein monster kill the monster Baragon, and then shortly thereafter there's a landslide and he's buried.
Yep, that's the one I've seen. Yep. Okay.
In the alternate version, right after Frankenstein kills Baragon, a giant octopus crawls up out of the ocean and grabs Frankenstein and pulls him under the water.
Actually, out of the lake, because they're up in the mountains in the Fuji area. Which is very strange, because generally octopus don't live in lakes, much less up in the mountains. But
it was very motivated.
Yeah, but yeah, that was the American side, who was co-funding the production, had asked, or at least the story goes that they had asked for that scene to be filmed, and ultimately when they saw it, they realized it didn't make any sense, so they didn't use it. So you got the footage that was made specifically for the American version that was never shown in America, and eventually only got wound up seeing in Japan.
Yeah, that's a strange film, but I do like this sort of pulp kind of feel that it has, where you start out with the Nazis bringing the heart of the Frankenstein monster to Japan during World War II and atomic exposure. It's a brutal film. It's got an American in it.
Nick
Adams. Nick Adams, who's appeared in... he appears in several Japanese productions.
Well, he's also in Monster Zero, and I think he was also might have been in some Japanese films that weren't monster films. I'm not sure.
Do you know much about his involvement with Japanese cinema? Like, how, why Nick Adams? I mean, like, how did he get that gig and become the American guy for these monster movies?
Well, they were looking for things to sell these films overseas, and one of the things that they could use for that purpose was to get, you know, a well-established Western actor. And Nick Adams happened to be the guy that they got. I think the story goes that originally they were trying to get somebody like David Janssen to do the part, but he turned it down, and Nick Adams, whose career wasn't going all that well at the time, decided to sign on. And Nick was kind of like a much more of a professional actor, that, you know, regardless of whether, you know, whether these were high-budget Hollywood films or not, he still gave it his all, and he did a good job at what he was given to do, and at least in Japan, among the staff, the director Honda and all his crew and the fellow actors, Nick was a very popular guy because he really took it seriously and gave a good effort in everything he did, unlike Russ Tamblyn, who would follow in his footsteps and do only one film in Japan because he pretty much thought everything about the production was beneath him, and he treated the whole thing with a great amount of disdain, and as a result was never asked back because nobody liked him there.
Nick Adams' career was cut pretty short. He was still very young when he died, and I think it was, to me it looks, I mean, well, I'm not a policeman, but he died of a drug overdose, if I remember correctly. But some of his, I think it was Forrest Tucker said he always thought he was murdered, but it seemed like a pretty obvious drug overdose to me. But what do I know? Nick was in Die Monster Die, which had Boris Karloff in it, and also was based on an H.P. Lovecraft story. But where I first saw Nick and loved his work was he did the movie version of No Time for Sergeants with Andy Griffith, which is just a fantastic movie.
Well, he was the rebel Johnny Yuma.
He was. I've never seen that show, but I knew that was where he got most of his pop culture popularity. And he was apparently good friends with James Dean, but or at least claimed to be. So. Anyway, died too young and is in a lot of films that are... in my collection that I like a lot. So,
any other misconceptions or falsehoods you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily falsehoods, but false impressions. You know, again, Japanese films tend to get a bad rap, especially some of the films from the 50s that were brought over here.
And that they're not cheap. Yeah.
Well, the way they are Americanized, in many cases, especially I'll use Gigantus, the Fire Monster, and Battle in Outer Space as prime examples. The companies that brought them over here didn't really treat them with a whole big amount of respect, and they gave them what I would call laughable dubbing tracks, which are not the fault of the company that produced the movie. It's the company that's releasing it over here. They're production of the American version was basically really poor, and unfortunately the films themselves wind up suffering by that association. You have, you know, like in Gigantus, you have one of the characters speaking in basically a Yogi Bear voice and some really terrible trite dialogue that they write for the dubbing script. They would change out music, put in, you know, library music or things that just weren't particularly appropriate. So Japanese films also kind of got a bad rap in the early stages, just because of, you know, some very poor dubbing jobs, things that were like the voices wouldn't match the character on the screen. The timing of the dubbing was bad. The voice actors were extremely poor. And all that kind of stuff, unfortunately, rubs off on the film itself, and the film's got a bad rap because of that.
So why do you think...
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, why do you think they did that to the movies?
Again, you know, in the case of some of these films, these are, you know, the producers and people who are bringing these products into the U.S. market at the time, they're all just looking for a quick buck, some kind of product to fill the double features up with at that time. And some of them took a lot of care in doing that. Some of them just found the cheapest way to do it possible. So, I mean, that really varied company by company. In the 60s, it was really like the best situation because a company by the name of American International picked up a lot of these films. And the studio that they had dubbing the films, Hydra Studios, did a fantastic job. They got real voice actors and they wrote, you know, professional dubbing scripts for these things. And they did a fantastic job. Those films sound really good. Unfortunately, those soundtracks are mostly lost today because American International went under and rights on some of those films reverted to Toho, and Toho will not use those dubbing tracks any longer. So you have films like Destroy All Monsters, which I think, you know, original version, original American version is terrific, but you hear the dubbing track that Toho uses on their video releases now. That was a track that was produced by them over in Asia, and it's atrocious. And it makes the film sound and look laughable in comparison. It's really not the same film. You know, Destroy All Monsters is a film I love, and I think after seeing the version that's out on video now, where they use the Toho's international dubbing track, that version is so terrible that if I had seen that version first, I probably wouldn't like that movie at all.
So I'd like to talk about Shin Godzilla, which some people call Godzilla Resurgence. I guess that's
the international title. I think that was the official international title.
Do you know the story of how that movie came to be? Because it seems quite different from the American version. So this was like a new American version that they recently did, 2014. But there is a big divergence in all these timelines, and I guess that's really where this question is going, is there an overarching timeline or how, you know, they're not, it's not like a reboot, but there's this weird shared universe or multiverse of Godzilla properties, and how does Shin Godzilla fit into that, or is anyone trying to make a canonical sort of encapsulation of all these properties? How does that work?
Well, Shin Godzilla is its own entity, and as of right now, it's the only film that exists in that universe, which is kind of unique because every time that they've rebooted the series before, they've always incorporated the first film. They always said, like, nothing else happened except for the first movie, but this time, this is completely starting over from scratch, so it's a remake in a sense.
That's correct.
Yeah.
The tone's really interesting. I mean, the original Godzilla was very, very serious, as we talked about earlier. This one seems more political in nature. Could you talk a little bit about what the theme is? Or, I mean, I don't want to spoil the movie. I mean, in some sense, it's almost like you can't spoil giant monster movies if the point is to watch giant monsters smashing stuff. But I think there's a lot going on in this film.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of political satire in it, almost like Dr. Strangelove. I don't want to put it in the, say it's on the same level as Dr. Strangelove. You know, it's not anywhere close to being that good, but it's kind of doing the same thing. A friend of mine who didn't like it compared it to a bad episode of The West Wing with a monster in it.
It was a divergent, not just in the history, but like the way Godzilla appears. The Godzilla doesn't just appear the way he appears at the end of the film. There's some things happening to his physical representation throughout the course of the film.
You know, in the Kawakita era, Kawakita was really keen on showing different phases of all the different monsters. So you'll see, outside of Godzilla, just about every other creature had multiple forms. That was his way to just get more creatures in a film. And even with Godzilla, you had the progression from baby to little to junior to the revived Godzilla after the parent melted down. So that's not unusual to see that in these films, but we're having Godzilla himself go through any kind of changes. This was certainly a unique thing.
You should say who Kawakita is.
Kawakita is the special effects director for the films that were made during the late 80s and the 90s. You know, if I could just for a moment go back to the political thing, because one thing I really want to mention about that is, yes, you know, Shin Godzilla itself is it's a very political movie, and in some ways that's one of the things that I do not appreciate about it, because it kind of stands on the head of what Honda had intended to do with Godzilla and why Godzilla was created. You know, Godzilla has never been, well, at least in my opinion, has not been a political symbol, or the movies haven't really been political. They've been about themes that are kind of universal, humanistic themes. And the fact that they would take Godzilla and use it for blatantly political means in this film, I find that a little bit disturbing to me. Maybe I take it a little differently because I'm so closely associated with this the Honda book and so interested in Honda's career and his intention for these films. But it kind of bothers me that the film is used in this way. Not so much the political satire, because, I mean, well, that's kind of like the... In fact, I don't think that that's particularly special or, you know, particularly good feature of this film, because it's such an easy thing to do. You know, the Japanese government is famous for being very slow and very bureaucratic. And so that's, you know, pretty much like low-hanging fruit that I think that anybody could make a pretty clever satire of the Japanese government. But the thing that bothers me much more is the highly nationalistic viewpoint that this film takes, that, you know, that it pretty much promotes the idea that Japan should disregard the Constitution and change it and make the military in Japan pretty much independent and able to do what they want. And I think back of, and I can't tell what Mr. Honda would have thought about that, but I would think that he'd be highly disappointed that, you know, the film property that he created for an entirely different purpose was now being used for this kind of scoring political points, because Godzilla was never about politics. It was always about the optimism for human beings, cooperation, warning against nuclear energy and all the dangers that it has inherent in it, but not, you know, not for making a blatantly political statement such as this film does. That's one of the things that really disturbs me about it.
I said before that I would probably like the film more if it were not Godzilla in it. If it had been a completely original film and they made up an entirely new monster, I might be more prone to enjoying the film. Although we should make the point here that whatever we think of it, the movie has done gangbuster business in Japan and, in fact, won several awards, including Best Picture in the Japanese Academy Awards.
Well, that's very true. And I think, you know, at least the way I look at this film is, and why I think it wound up being so popular in Japan, is that it's Godzilla for people who don't care about Godzilla. It's, its focus is not very much on Godzilla himself. It's on all this political satire, and then they kind of sneak in the nationalistic bent towards the end of the movie. A lot of people who don't normally go see these kind of films went to see this film. That's why it wound up being so popular. And in my company, because my business is headquartered in Japan, so I have multiple trips there each year. And, you know, a lot of the people in the office in Japan know that, you know, I'm really interested in Godzilla. So when they all went to see it, they were all interested to talk to me about it. And almost to a person, everybody thought that, you know, one of the reasons they really liked this film was because it shows Japan supposedly acting on their own and solving their own problems. and you know that kind of, and of course they also enjoyed making fun of the government. But you know the only thing that they didn't talk about was Godzilla. They didn't really seem to really care about that because Godzilla was just the reason for that, for all this political satire. And you know, that was what, in general, at least in the small sample size of people that I talked to who are in no way fans, that's what people were kind of really, you know, latching onto as far as what made it popular for them.
I find it really interesting how Japan has changed. I mean, since, like, before World War II, you know, hugely imperialistic military power. And so since World War II, they're literal, I guess, legally mandated behavior has been more pacifistic, and you know, they've been more involved in. I think people tend to think of it more as a technological capitalistic, you know, culture than as a political military power, right? And that's because of how efficient they were. And my goodness, they were really good at being a military imperialistic government. They were very effective. So to see this is quite a shift. As you say, I guess the themes of the older films were more about the dangers of that everybody faces, all countries face with nuclear power and nuclear bombs. And I imagine that Godzilla, in the Godzilla verse, there have been other sort of overarching human problems. I mean, right now, I find Godzilla versus Hedorah to be more effective message about the dangers of pollution than the crying Native American from the commercials in the 70s. So, I mean, when I think about using Godzilla for, or using kaiju in general as these, would that be symbolic archetype type things? Can you think of some other cases where any kaiju have been used this way?
I think you're asking where, how, in what various ways the films have been used to address social and political issues. Other than Hetero, which you just mentioned, another film, Godzilla's Revenge, or also known as All Monsters Attack. It gets a little bit confusing because a lot of these movies have multiple titles, so we're not always sure about what movie we're talking about. But this is the 1969 film where pretty much all the monsters are just imaginary in this kid's head. And that film was used to address the latchkey kid phenomenon that was going on in Japan at that time, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. Again, another social issue. That's, again, kind of my, I don't really think Godzilla's ever been used for political purposes until this. But another example would be Biollante, which is a warning against the dangers of biotechnology.
Oh, that's when the monster is crossed with a rose bush, right?
Yes.
All Monsters Attack is strange because it's probably my least favorite of the films from the storyline perspective. But it has so many awesome monsters in it, right? So, you know, is that the only film with Kumanga? It may be.
Oh, no. In fact, that was stock footage. Kumanga, also known as Spiga, that's another thing that changes names a lot. A lot of these monster names change, but it was from Son of Godzilla. And I think the island in that movie is Solgale Island.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I need to rewatch that. So Son of Godzilla is Minya?
Minya, yeah.
Okay.
And also, I think also that monster, Kumanga, Spiga, whatever you want to call it, is also in Destroy All Monsters briefly, but I think that's stock footage too.
And I guess, does he show up or she? I'm not really sure if it's a boy or girl, but is in Final Wars Part 1 or 2? I don't remember.
Yes, yeah. And she's, I assume it's a she just because it's a spider. But, yeah. also in Final Wars, yes.
Yeah. I assume that, and again, this is me making an assumption, but it may not be quite right. There's a very similar monster in Kong Skull Island, that certainly looks, if not directly supposed to be Kumanga, looks very similar.
Spider crab. Yeah.
Very cool. I had to see that movie twice to see it completely because we had a little family emergency come up in the middle of the first attempt. So I now have that successfully under my belt, and if listeners manage to go see the film, if you like giant monsters, I highly recommend it. I don't know if you'll like the plot, but boy howdy, they do some fun giant monster stuff in there.
And you stay through to the end credits, right?
Great fun there at the end.
Yes, please don't tell me what it is, guys. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I'm pleased with the way that the Legendary Monsterverse is panning out. I don't like everything that's been done in those two films, but for the most part, I like them more than not.
They're very expensive to make, and I guess now they're more expensive. So, but you know, CGI looks fantastic now in ways that it didn't before. It used to be very flat looking in a three-dimensional world. The new stuff's looking better, but on the way TV definitions are increasing, when you watch these movies at home, sometimes it's, for me at least, it's hard to enjoy CG work compared to practical effects. And so I like to watch old movies sometimes in these Blu-ray releases, and then I'm always surprised when the old practical effects look phenomenal. I mean, they just look so good, and then the CG looks clunky. It's almost...
The problem with the CGI for me is no other effect ages as poorly as CGI. And something that was done even as recently as 5 years ago can age really bad.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't have that problem with stop motion or suitmation or virtually anything else.
And I don't know what it, again, this is a cost issue, I imagine, but I mean, people, Moore's Law takes effect and computers get more and more powerful, it becomes possible to do some really incredible rendering on less expensive machines. And copyright kind of prevents this, but I maybe in my lifetime, and they've extended it so long, but maybe some of these films will get some really nice, you know, fan-based touch-up work or something. Maybe it's not within the power of these movie companies to put together the funding to, like, fix. And I'm very hesitant. This is an artistic question. These guys were doing the best they could with what they had. But it's also this incredibly rich treasure trove of material that some, you know, young people today may not even want to bother with because the effects don't look as good. So... Now, my kids have really enjoyed them, but I don't know if it's universal, because some people were like, oh, that looks lame, and they never really get in and enjoy the film. You got to, like, get past the disbelief part, I think, to really get a good experience here. There's an animated Godzilla project in the works.
And it was just announced that, at least in our market, it's going to be on Netflix.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And this is going to be direct to Netflix? Do we know how many episodes there are going to be, that kind of thing?
It's supposed to be a feature film.
Oh, okay. So it's a feature film, but it's done is it computer animated style or traditional?
Well, I'm not sure yet what, I mean, they call it computer graphic animation, but I really don't know what it's going to look like. If it's going to be something like Final Fantasy kind of thing, where they try and render everything, you know,
right,
fully, or whether it's just going to be your traditional cell animation augmented by computers. I mean, that's until we start seeing something, you know, some actual frames from it, it's hard to say what it's going to be like.
The company responsible is called Polygon Pictures. They're the same people who did the Clone Wars TV show, and I think they exclusively do 3D animation. Although some of the stuff that they've done looks a lot like cell animation.
Interesting.
Which I would be very pleased if that's the route they went. The more it looks like cell animation rather than 3D, the happier I'd be.
I think it would be a much better choice. I would agree with that.
And when you say 3D, you don't mean like put on the glasses. You mean 3D style, whereas like it's got depth to it.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. That,
yeah.
We don't really have a term around here exactly at my house, but my son is really... When we talk about an animated film, he always wants to know if it's going to look more like a flat, you know, 2D or a 3D rendering. But we're a little unclear what the best term for that is. But I like that. I mean, it just gets confusing when people think you need to put on glasses versus not. But fully rendered spaces versus cell-based rendering. It is amazing what can be done. It just surprises me how expensive it is, because it seems like no matter how much people are able to do at home, the price that the movie studios claim for the cost of producing these things keeps going up and up and up. And, you know, fans and amateurs can do such astonishing work. And I'm always confounded that it's so expensive and such a lengthy process to bring these things out to market when, you know, the demand is always going to exceed the ability to produce, I suppose.
The thing this company has done that I think looks the best was something called Knights of Cydonia. That also is supposed to be, that's exactly what I said. It's a 3D animation, but it looks like it's cell animation, so I'm happy with it.
Is that S-I-D or S-E-D?
S-I-D-O-N-I-A.
That's interesting. I wonder if it's related to Mars in some way. There's that whole Sardonia. That's where the Face on Mars region is. So there's a new sequel coming out to the Godzilla 2014 that looks like it's going to somehow tie into what's being done with Kong on Skull Island.
Supposedly in the new film, or Godzilla King of the Monsters, as they're calling it, that's going to have Rodan, Mothra, and King Ghidorah, all four monsters, supposedly.
Sweet.
Which I'm not sure that's such a great idea to do so soon. I think perhaps that should have been spread out over a couple of films. I mean, in the original Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, you also had all four monsters, but most of the monsters had already been established in previous movies.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So from a storytelling perspective, it's probably more acceptable to your brain to ease yourself into a world with these giant monsters rather than just suddenly there were none and now there's, look at this, you know, here's all of them, you know.
Well, one of the problems I see with that is that you wind up just kind of escalating things so quickly that you leave yourself no room to go in the future.
But
I always told people when I saw the first Avengers, it's like, okay, well, that was really great, but where do you go from there? Because I don't know how you're going to, you know, top that in terms of the spectacle at the end. And sure enough, I mean, what you got with the second film is pretty much exactly the same thing. The big giant battle with lots of minions from the other side that, you know, you have a big, long, extended battle with. But you really can't go too much farther beyond that. And if you do something like this, where you're going to start adding 3-4 extra, you know, monsters in it and having a big battle with them, then, I mean, what's next? Do you have to have 10 monsters in the next one and 15 in the next one? You just set yourself up for, you know, not being able to top yourself, or if you do try and top yourself, you wind up taking something that just winds up starting to get ridiculous because it gets to be, like, overblown. So that's my concern with them going this far this fast.
And also it comes into the thing about in the reboot of Godzilla, they introduced the idea of mutos, and that's what I don't know if you would call them the villains of the film were, but these are massive unidentified terrestrial organisms. The thing is, though, that's like UFOs, right? It's a classification of an unknown phenomena. But the monsters themselves represent only one of basically any class of unknown monster that's going to appear after this. So until you identify it, it's a muto, no matter what it looks like, right? So it's a strange approach because they make reference to that in the Kong film, and I'm curious if that happened. And this is just me being a nerd, but what's going to happen to the two creatures we saw in the first Godzilla film? If mutos are an entire class, those things will need their own specific name, right? So to sort of differentiate them from all the other unknown creatures. Of course, the new ones, we already know what they are, at least in the sense that, as you say, these monsters are going to appear in the next Godzilla film. I find it really interesting because I like all of these monsters and I like to see them. And it's always been a problem with these from a narrative perspective that most humans are only concerned with humans for storylines, right? So the drama comes from what happens to people. So they always have to tack on a human story to make us enjoy the monster story, or at least that's what the people who produce these seem to believe. I'm not sure it's true. I feel pretty comfortable that I could watch a movie with just a bunch of monsters doing stuff. I don't necessarily need to have a love interest and a human villain and all those other complications to enjoy the films. But since they won't get made unless somebody's willing to dump millions of dollars into it, and those approvals are always going to require those basic narrative tools, I guess I'm out of luck until I get the ability to, or until fans are able to do these sort of things on their own. I don't know. Do you ever just sort of wish that they could just do monster movies with giant monsters and not necessarily have to have people?
I don't know if I ever thought that.
No.
Negative.
That's probably another one of the reasons I didn't care much for Shin Godzilla, because pretty much there is no human story in that. And it's almost, I guess, in a way they try to make it more like a documentary, because there's really no characters or no people you get to know or people who have any story behind them. They're just kind of like, they're there and they're reacting and, okay, that's it. But there's really no particular story to it.
Well, I feel like we're about to enter what could either be a renaissance or a disaster, and we won't really know until it happens.
I don't know that it's going to be any new era. I think this, again, Shin Godzilla, to me, strikes me as a one-off effort. Okay, so I don't know that it's necessarily going to lead and be the leader in a certain direction or not. I think it would be very difficult for them to follow up and continue that storyline, especially since Anno's not interested in going any further with it. So I think probably it's going to be a lot like the Millennium films, where the next film is just going to be yet again somebody else's take on the same thing.
Well, if you could see them redo any of these other properties that haven't already been scheduled, what other monster movie would you be interested in seeing them revisit?
Well, honestly, I'd just as soon see somebody try something new instead of constantly going after remaking and remaking and remaking.
Oh, I mentioned that I'm fond of the British monster Gorgo, so I'd like to see that again.
Yeah, I think my favorite, just as far as standalone films, might have been Rodan, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I love the. I think they've had time to see it, though, right? Don't you? So I can.
It's only been 50 something years since. So,
I loved it. How in the story, the there's something happening in this mine, and they're not really clear on what's going on exactly, and then they find out there's these giant worm monsters, and they're like, oh no, these giant worm monsters, they're, it's causing earthquake type effects, it's killing miners, and you're like, that's horrific, they're so big and dangerous. And then you find out that those are just the things that Rodan eats. That's just his food for baby Rodan. I mean, like, and there's more than one. So that's the kind of almost Lovecraftian level shocker that just blew me away when I was a kid. And, I think it suffers from the special effects don't hold up so well. But I love that story. And I would love to see that kind of level of surprise in a monster film. And that's very unusual it's hard to come up with surprises, I guess. So
that's one of the few films where I would say a case could be made for saying that the American version is actually superior to the original Japanese version.
Oh, really? What's the difference?
Of Rodan? Well, in both films, you have the two Rodan monsters. But in the American version, the second monster is introduced much, much earlier. And in the Japanese version, it's just, like, thrown in there almost at the last minute, very nonchalantly, almost like an afterthought.
Yeah, it kind of comes out of nowhere, what's that? Why did that happen?
Oh, really? So that's like an editing choice they made, or did the Americans do reshoots?
No reshoots, but they just using reversed footage and changing a few of the events in the film, they just made the second one show up much earlier.
Wow, I never noticed that. So that's, I've only seen the American version based on what you just told me. That's interesting, so. And I was always, I really enjoyed that film. Lots of people get eaten. It's good stuff. So,
what's weird too, though, is that in the American version, there's a visual faux pas that only happens in that version of the film, and it's not in the Japanese one. One scene where they're at an airport, and you look out the window, and what ends up happening is that they were, this was just film footage of an airport that was being projected behind them for some reason, because they obviously they were shooting this in the studio, so they're not really at an airport, so they just have film footage behind them.
Sure.
But there's one part where in the American version it starts looping over, so like you see a vehicle moving, and then all of a sudden it starts going backwards.
Well, I think that's because they wanted to extend the dialogue in that scene, and they just looped the footage backwards rather than cut the dialogue down to fit the scene. And I can't say for sure if that's what happened, but I mean, I can't imagine any other reason why that would happen, because I'm sure they didn't have the separate elements of the match shot in order to redo that. So I'm sure that they just rewound the footage back just to extend, like I said, just to extend the dialogue so that it fit what, the American people had done for that particular scene.
Yeah, we haven't talked at all about Gamera or Daimajin or Gafo or Gilala.
That's true. How does Gamera fit into this, in real history, how does Gamera fit into the Japanese cinema history? Like, was he a direct response to Godzilla, or?
Well, in short answers, yes. It was just, 1965, Daiei wanted some of that Daikaiju money action that Godzilla was getting, because these films were popular in the 60s. They weren't the only type of Japanese film that was popular, but I guess there were also like the Zatoichi films, samurai, movies. There were comedies. There were lots of films that were popular, but giant monster movies were a type of film that were popular. So Dai wanted some of Toho's action, so they made their own monster.
And Gamera has spawned quite a few sequels. I'm guessing a lot of our listeners will have seen them primarily through Mystery Science Theater 3000. Yeah. They seem to be more kid focused. That's my take on it. I mean, were they deliberately targeted at children?
Yes, very intentionally. So Noriaki Yuasa, who made most of those movies, just really liked kids, and he wanted to make movies that were friendly for kids. So that's why Gamera became the friend of all children.
Which is kind of ironic, because when you look at those old films, they couldn't be more bloody and violent.
Right, exactly.
At the same time, which I always thought was very peculiar, that, Yuasa was really totally interested in making these films for very small kids, but at the same time, he put images in there that were particularly gruesome. I mean, Guile's getting his head chopped off, and there's always Gamera's blood is flowing like water, because actually it is water. and things like that happen, which at the same time at Toho, that was something that Tsuburaya was vehemently against, showing Godzilla bleeding, that kind of thing, that kind of violence. So that was kind of an interesting contradiction that was in those the old Gamera films.
Yeah,
and then think about it too. And then what happened is those films, for whatever reason, were popular enough that it finally, with Godzilla's Revenge, it kind of prompted Toho to answer back. And I think Godzilla's Revenge was their answer back to a film that could target the same audience. And that's why you got, after Destroy All Monsters, they kind of went backwards and kind of went to a very simple, low-cost type of production, and what that production wound up being was, like I said, a direct response to Daiei, and I think that in doing so, they beat Daiei at their own game.
That's interesting. That reminds me of the sort of the parallels between Hammer and Amicus films. It's like Amicus went so far as to even use a lot of the same actors, so.
Right, same type of thing. And we should mention that for a long time, fans of the genre have considered the Gamera films to be just inferior copies of the Godzilla movies. But an interesting thing happened in the 1990s when Gamera was rebooted, and they had this trilogy of new Gamera films that were a complete remake. and Godzilla movies were being remade. Those Godzilla movies in the 90s were happening at the same time. But the general consensus seems to be that the Gamera films of the 1990s are, not only are they better than the Godzilla films of the 1990s, but they are among the best giant monster movies and or monster movies period ever made.
They're very popular here at my house.
Yeah.
I think Godzilla gets more rewatch, but I think there's, in general, I enjoy watching those, and my kids like them quite a bit. So I don't know. That's anecdotal, but I like the special effects in them, and they have a nice story arc. I am curious, though, like, Gamera is such an odd creature because he bleeds, so he seems to be biological, yet he flies through space and shoots flames out of his leg holes. He's an odd cat. I don't know what his story is exactly. So, people, and we'll even do it for this episode, I'll talk a little bit about the why these kaiju are biologically impossible. But trying to explain that about Gamera just is silly. I mean, he's clearly not. He's more of a fantasy creature, I guess.
And even Gamera seems realistic compared to some of the things that crop up in Japanese television shows.
Yeah. Wow, and there's been a lot of that too. I would imagine that Ultraman and Spectre Man, these also were sort of kicked off by the kaiju films.
Yeah, well, pretty much everything, in the mid-60s, that was the kaiju boom, when, we had Godzilla vs. the Thing, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, so theatrically those films were doing very well. Toho had been producing a few other films at the same time, Dogura, Atragon, and then at the same time, Tsuburaya had started up Ultra Q and Ultraman, so all around this time period there was the big boom in monster films in monsters in Japan. TV was starting to eat away at it, but you had not only Dai went in with Gamera, and then the following year you had Gappa from Mikatsu and Urala from Shochiku. So yeah, everybody was kind of getting on the bandwagon at that point, and unfortunately, very quickly, it all started to fall apart as TV started to suck the life out of the feature film business. It was a lot easier for kids to stay at home and watch monsters on TV for free than it was to have mom and dad take them to the theater and pay to see pretty much the same thing. Quality-wise, it wasn't really the same thing, but especially for younger children, that was probably pretty much the mindset. So, yeah, unfortunately, the proliferation of monsters, especially as far as it goes to TV, started the monster film industry on the downswing.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, but I did get some great memories from that. I liked, in America it was called Space Giants, but I guess in Japan it was Ambassador Magma.
Yeah, Magma Taishi.
That's just it's a trippy show, but I mean, it's got a family of robots with the father being, I don't know, what is he, 50 feet tall, 100 feet tall, something like that. He's really big.
Yeah, 100 feet tall in the translated version. I don't know how accurate that is, though.
It's got shapeshifters and aliens and giant monsters, and it's awesome. And it's long. It's like 52 episodes.
Yeah.
So, there's just a tremendous amount of fun material out there.
So, I know, unfortunately, we're running out of time here, but I wanted to ask the question that we always like to ask our guests, but we're going to modify it just a little bit, because before we even did this interview, I know you've expressed some reservations about picking a single favorite monster. So, I'm going to ask it this way.
Yes.
What are some of your favorite monsters, and what do you think your favorite kaiju film is?
Shall I go first?
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there's only one king, so that's going to be my favorite monster.
Excellent. Okay.
Huh?
I say Kong, excellent, right? America.
Yeah. So to spell it out for people out there, yeah, Godzilla takes first place. Second place, I would put King Ghidorah, or King Ghidra, or Ghidra, however you're going to pronounce it. You can pronounce it all those ways. They're all correct.
One name for each head.
Yes. One. But unfortunately, I don't think he's been done justice since the 1960s. And in third place, I'll throw a curveball and put in the British monster Gorgo and his mother.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, you've thought about this.
Uh-huh. And I guess
after huge show notes on this episode. Sorry.
Right. And I don't really have any of that fall into line after that. You know, I like Angulus. I like Mothra. I like Rodan. I guess I like Rodan more than Angulus and Mothra. So we'll put Rodan at number four, and we'll just put Mothra at number five.
Okay, Ed.
Well, I mean, obviously, Godzilla, without a doubt, is number one. I mean, Godzilla is the reason that all of this got started, and it's the probably the most iconic monster character that ever came out of Japan. It'd be hard to pick against Godzilla. But beyond Godzilla, I would have to agree with Mike that King Ghidorah is probably the second on my list. It's just, you know, such an impressive looking design, and you just I can still think back to the day that I saw that film in the theater, Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, and how overwhelming that experience was, and seeing that creature on the screen the first time. It's something that I'll never forget. So yeah, I would put Ghidorah as second, and probably my third favorite giant monster would be Mothra. Mothra is just, again, it's a kind of iconic figure, and I like the idea of the simplicity of its design. I think that, you know, it's in all too often, you know, people get a little, especially today, you know, when people are designing creatures and spaceships and stuff, they go overboard on detail and making it look complicated. I'm kind of the opposite approach. You know, I think simplicity is better. There's beauty in simplicity, just like in spaceships. You'll take the Enterprise over everything else, because the Enterprise is just a couple of simple lines, and it's basically frozen motion. Looks beautiful the way it is, and I'll, you know, apply the same kind of thinking to Mothra. Mothra has that simplicity of design that is elegant and very impressive.
I shouldn't ask any more questions because I know we're out of time, but Godzuki or Scrappy-Doo? Godzuki or Scrappy-Doo, who's the worst?
Well, I will actually watch the Hanna-Barbera Godzilla and hate it. And the Scrappy-Doo, I just won't even watch. So,
the Scrappy-Doo is worse. Yeah.
And death is not an option.
Are we talking about for the characters?
Yeah, I hate Godzuki. Yeah. Every time I hear Godzuki, I hear "and Godzuki," and then the
don't
little circus that. Music.
Don't stop.
Yeah, can't stop.
That says it all.
All right. Thanks so much for coming, guys. We really enjoyed talking.
Thank you so much. Yeah. That was fun.
You're welcome. We love it.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. Today you heard Blake Smith and Karen Stolzno interview Michael Keller and Ed Gottschalksi about Godzilla and other giant monsters. Please check out the show notes at monstertalk.org for links to their work. We appreciate their sharing so much of their time with us to talk about these awesome monsters. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions you heard today were those of ourselves and our guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. I'm not even sure that Skeptic Magazine has an official position on Godzilla. Heck, they probably don't even believe it's a real threat.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
One more quick mention, Monster Talk fan Jeff Zornow does some fantastic Godzilla art. You can find him on Twitter at ZORNOW13, and there's a link to his artwork in the show notes. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Want to stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
Boy, howdy, they do some fun giant monster stuff in there.
And you stay through to the end credits, right?
Great fun there at the end.
Yes, please don't tell me what it is, guys. I haven't seen it yet.
No, no, I wouldn't tell you, but I was just saying Matthew. I'm just saying Matthew Broderick still looks great. He's aged so well. That's all I'm saying. What?
I'm not sure if the banana was necessary.
It was important to the plot. Okay.